Well, thank you very much, Wes. Yes, I certainly don't think I'm a vegetarian butcher. I think I need both the insights of science and the insights of religion if I'm really to understand the rich and varied world in which we live. Science and religion are friends, not foes. And the basic reason they're friends is that they're both concerned with the search for truth. Truth, of course, as you all know, is as essential to religion as it is to science. A religious belief can do all sorts of things for you. It can guide you in life or sustain you in the approach of death, but it can't really do any of these things unless it's actually true. Otherwise, it would just be some form of illusionary wishful thinking. But the question of truth is central to both, but of course they're looking at different levels, different kinds of truth. They're asking different questions about the world. Essentially, science is asking the question of how things happen. What are the processes by which things come about? And religion is asking a different, and in my view, deeper set of questions about why things are happening. Is there meaning and purpose and value what's going on in the world? We're perfectly familiar with the fact that you can both ask and answer both sorts of questions about the same thing. A homely example that I like to refer to is the boiling kettle. You come into my kitchen at home, the kettle's boiling, I have my scientific hat on, when I say to you, the kettle is boiling, there's burning gas, heats the water, when the temperature of the water gets to 100 degrees Celsius, a phase change, as the physicists say, takes place, where in plainer terms, the water boils. That's of course true, and it's way worth knowing, but nothing stops me taking off my scientific hat and saying the kettle is boiling because I want to make a cup of tea. Would you like to have one? I don't have to choose between those two answers. And if I'm to understand the mysterious event of the boiling kettle, I have to ask and answer both those questions. So I need the insights of science into how things happen in the world and to the insights of science, of a religion rather, about what is happening in the world, whether there's meaning or value or purpose of what's going on. I want to say those few things before I start on the main subject of my talk. But what might start my talk is to talk about paradise, the theme of this Green Belt meeting. As I'm sure you all know, and probably been told several times before today, paradise comes from a Persian word meaning garden. And I want to use the image of a garden as some sort of picture to guide us through what I want to try and say. Because what I want to talk about is I want to talk about the history of the universe, the whole history of the universe. That's, of course, obviously of great scientific interest, and we've made enormous strides in the last 100 years in unravelling that history. But, of course, from a religious point of view, it's also the history of creation. And that's how we need to look at it to fully understand what's going on. And we all know, that, of course, that creation isn't simply about how things began, but why things exist at all. Why is there something rather than nothing? God is not there to be the answer to who lit the blue touch paper of the Big Bang. God is always the creator of the world. God is as much the creator of the world today as God was 13.7 billion years ago when the fiery singularity, the fiery event of the Big Bang took place. So it's the whole history of the universe which is relevant to the whole history of creation. Now gardens start, if you're starting at making a garden from scratch, gardens start extremely simple, just a bare stretch of earth. And the universe also started extremely simple. As you all know, the universe started 13.7 billion years ago, so it's getting very exact about these things these days. It started as simply almost uniform expanding ball of energy. It's just about the simplest physical system that we can think of. In fact, one of the reasons why cosmologists were able to talk very confidently, and I think justifiably very often, about the very early universe is it is a very simple physical system. It's very easy to think about it. But that world which started so simple has now become very rich and complex. There was great potentiality in that ball of energy. just as there is great potentiality in a bare stretch of earth for the making of a beautiful and varied garden. That ball of energy has turned, in the course of that almost 14 billion years of cosmic history, has turned out to be the home of saints and scientists. That's a very remarkable thought in itself, the enormous potentiality and fruitfulness of the world. And the potentiality of that happening was built into the physical universe right from the start. Although, as far as we know, life didn't appear in the universe until it was about 10 billion years old. And, of course, self-conscious human life only appeared in the universe yesterday, in cosmic terms. But there's a very real sense in which the universe was pregnant with the possibility of life from the very beginning. By that I mean that if the laws of nature, the given laws of nature, which science uses to understand what's going on in the world, but doesn't of itself explain, those very laws of nature had not taken a very precise, very finely tuned form, that amazingly fruitful history would not have been possible, and we of course wouldn't be here today. The laws of nature have to take a finely tuned form in a world that is capable of such a remarkable consequence as evolving carbon-based life. That's a very surprising conclusion. Most of us, I think, as scientists, would have thought that our universe is just a common or garden specimen of what a universe might be like, something you could buy at the local universe shop, so to speak. But we come to realize that it's a very, very particular universe indeed. Just give you a couple of reasons why we think that's so. What is this? The chemistry of life, for life you need about 20 to 30 chemical elements, but the crucial chemical element for life is carbon. The chemistry of life is the chemistry of carbon. Carbon is the basis of those long chain molecules, which are the biochemical basis of life. But the very early universe, when it started off, it was extremely hot. It was a sort of expanding cosmic hydrogen bomb. But as it expanded, it cooled down. And it cooled down pretty quickly. In fact, in about 3 minutes. It was sufficiently cool, for nuclear processes no longer to be happening all over the universe. So the world was frozen out in its nuclear structure at that stage with whatever had been made by that hectic first 3 minutes. Because the early universe was so simple, it only made very simple things. And it turned out that the first 3 minutes only made the two simplest chemical elements, which are hydrogen and helium. You can't do anything very interesting chemically with hydrogen and helium on their own. So where did carbon come from? There's only one place in the whole universe where carbon is made, and that is in the interior nuclear furnaces of the stars. Every atom of carbon in your body was once inside a star, where people of stardust. That in itself, I think, is a very remarkable thought to think about. But it is more remarkable than that, because it turns out the process by which carbon is made is extremely delicate. And it only works because the laws of nuclear physics take a very precise, finely tuned form. To make carbon out of helium, what you have to do is you have to take three helium nuclei and make them stick together. That turns helium-4 into carbon-12. But with tiny things like nuclei, you can't stick them all together at once. They're just too small to do that. So you've got to do it in sequence. Okay, you say, we stick two together. That makes beryllium-8. Hope it stays around for a bit. Another helium comes along, attaches itself, and bingo, we've got carbon. That's the obvious way to think, but it doesn't actually work that way. The reason it doesn't work that way is the beryllium-8 is fantastically unstable. It's just gone like that. In the normal sort of way, it wouldn't stay there long enough to give the chance of sticking on that third helium nucleus. And it's only because there is a very special effect, a very large effect, in the trade we call it a resonance, occurring at just the right energy in carbon to attach that third helium nucleus much, much quicker than you thought. And in fact, to catch some of the beryllium and produce the carbon. Unless the laws of nuclear physics had been exactly what they are, either there would be no resonance at all, or it would have been at the wrong energy. We're here today simply because of that fine-tuning of the laws of nuclear physics. That's one example of how special a world it is that we live in. We don't live in any old universe. We live in a very special universe. And just one more thing that you need to get something like life. We live in a universe that's immensely big. Our star is just an ordinary star among the 100,000 million stars of our galaxy, the Milky Way. And the Milky Way is just a perfectly ordinary galaxy among the 100,000 million galaxies of the universe, the observable universe. Sometimes we feel upset at the thought of that vast, vast immensity. Can there be any significance for us, inhabitants of a speck of cosmic dust? Well, if all those trillions of stars weren't there, we wouldn't be here to be upset at the thought of them, because it turns out that you need a vast, vast universe to even have the possibility of making life. It's not a process that can be hurried. It takes time. You've got to make the carbon, that takes 10 million years, 10 billion years, and so on. And a universe only lasts very long, but it's also very big. And if our universe had not been as big as it is, it wouldn't have been possible for life to develop. So we live in a very special world, but with potentiality. Just as gardens maybe have special sorts of soil, which all sorts of special plants and fruits can develop. Now, of course, the process which has turned that initial ball of energy into the home of saints and scientists has been an evolving process. And it's a very deep scientific insight that new things come into being in very special circumstances, very special regimes, as we say. Regimes which are at the edge of chaos, as we like to say. That means regimes which are neither too disorderly nor too orderly. You need a mixture of both. If things are too orderly, things are just too rigid for anything new to happen. We can have rearrangements of the bits and pieces. Nothing really new will happen if it's just too orderly, too rigid. But equally, of course, if it's too disorderly, it's too haphazard, then any new thing that comes to me will just fall apart again. So you need just the right balance between order and disorder at the edge of chaos for really new things to happen, for a world that started as a ball of energy to be able to become the home of saints and scientists. Now that edge of chaos means that there is, if you like, a snake in Eden, in the paradise. Because, of course, at the edge of chaos, though that interaction between order and disorder will produce such amazing consequences as human beings, we'll also have ragged edges and blind alleys. An evolutionary process cannot be simple and clear-cut and free of any cost in any sort of way. Just think about the evolution of life here on Earth, the 3.5 billion year history of the life here on Earth. The engine which has driven that process that turned a world of bacteria into the world with you and me in it, that process was, of course, driven by genetic mutation. Genetic mutations take place, they produce new forms of life, which are then sifted and preserved through natural selection. But if germ cells, the cells that produce new life, are able to mutate in a way that's necessary for that, it will also be true of somatic cells, that's to say of body cells. And sometimes when body cells mutate, they will become malignant. So you see, there is a shadow side to evolution. There is a snake in Eden. You can't have one without the other. You can't have new forms of life without having the risk of blind alleys, ragged edges in that process. The fact that there is cancer in the world is an anguishing fact about the world. But it's not something that a creator who is a bit more competent or a bit less callous could easily have eliminated. It is the inevitable cost of a world evolving and making itself in a God-given way through this kind of process. So just as weeds will grow as well as flowers in gardens, there will be a shadow side, the process. And I think that helps us a bit as we struggle with what is undoubtedly, in my view, the greatest problem for religious belief, presence of evil and suffering in a world, physical evil and suffering in a world, believed to be the creation of a good and powerful creator. Well, I've tried to give you a very quick sketch of cosmic history. I've tried to look, to give you the salient points from a scientific point of view. Try to suggest that these are correlated in ways consonant with, correlated with, theological ways of understanding the Creator and the Creator's purposes. And we'd be looking back over that 13.7 billion year history. But of course, scientists can not only peer into the past, they can to some extent peer into the future. And when you look into the future and ask, how is this universe so fruitful? How is it going to end? And the short answer to that is, badly. The universe at the present is expanding, and we think it is most likely that it will continue to expand. As it continues to expand, it will get colder and colder, it will also get more and more dilute. So that eventually, and it'll take a long time, it'll take tens of billions of years, eventually if things just go on as they are, then the universe will die. All life will disappear from the universe, anywhere at all. Become too cold, too dilute for life to exist. Every story that science has to tell ends eventually in futility and decay. If by any chance the expansion was reversed and then the universe collapsed again, that wouldn't be any better, that wouldn't solve the problem. What began with the Big Bang, then with the Big Crunch, so everything fell into a cosmic melting pot. So one way or the other, the universe is going to die. That immediately raises the question of what is the Creator's purpose in the history of a creation which, however fruitful it may be today, is eventually going to end in futility in that kind of way. Eventually paradise, for sure, is going to be lost. That's a very serious question which we need to address, and as truth-seeking religious people, we need to address. And I think it actually doesn't pose any more problem in a way than the even more certain knowledge that we have that we are going to die. Not, of course, on a quite so long a time scale as the universe, on a time scale of tens of years. In the end, we're going to die. As I say, every story that science tells, that's a very natural extrapolation of the way the world is working at the moment, is going to end in decay and futility. I have a friend, Stephen Weinberg, who's a very, very distinguished theoretical physicist and a very, very staunch atheist. And he says, talking about these things, he says, the more I understand the universe, he says, the more it seems pointless. If in the end, it's all going to disappear. The general statement of this futility is contained in that scientific law, which I'm sure you've heard about, called the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says that if you don't interfere with the system from the outside in some sort of way, it will progressively become more and more disorderly. And the reason for that is simply that there are many, many more ways for things to be disorderly than there are orderly. So there is a statistical push in the direction of ever-increasing disorder. The waters of chaos will rise and rise and rise again. And that's another way of expressing the ultimate futility in terms of, anyway, the science, story that science can tell. But science's story is just one story. It is the horizontal story, the extrapolation of present processes. But religious belief, theology, has a second story to tell, a different story, which is, so to speak, the vertical story, the story which is of the faithfulness of the Creator, the God. So the last word is not spoken by the second law of thermodynamics. The last word lies with God, with the creator of the world. And the only hope we have for ourselves or for the whole created universe, the only hope we have for a destiny beyond death, lies in the faithfulness of the world's creator. That is the only and the sufficient ground for the hope of a destiny beyond death, either for the cosmos or for ourselves. And you remember, that's exactly the point that Jesus made when he had his argument with the Sadducees about whether there was a human destiny beyond death. You all know the story, it comes in Mark 12. The Sadducees were a small but very influential and very conservative set of Jewish believers in the first century. They ran the temple in Jerusalem. They were very conservative in their religious views, and they only accepted as authoritative the five books of the Law of Moses, the five books of the Torah, Genesis to Deuteronomy. They didn't accept the rest of what we would call the Old Testament, the rest of the Hebrew Scriptures, as authoritative. They didn't believe in a destiny beyond death, but they didn't think they found in those five books any promise of a destiny beyond death. So they come to Jesus to argue the toss with him, and Jesus, they tell it, do it in a very characteristically Jewish way by telling a story, and I'm sure you remember the story. The story is of this woman. She is married to a man. Unfortunately, the man dies before they have any children. And it is that the man has six other brothers, and it is a duty for the oldest brother to marry the wife in the hope of producing children for his brother's posterity. So he steps up and does that. And unfortunately, he dies too, without there being any children. So the next brother steps up. This is a very unfortunate family. And at the end, all seven brothers have had the woman as their wives, but there have been no children of the marriages. And now the Pharisees come to the Sadducees come to what they think is the key point, the killing point at the end. They say, whose wife then would she be in the world to come? In other words, if there is a destiny beyond death, how can we make sense of all the entanglements and complications that have taken place in this life? And Jesus deals with these questioners in a way that he so often did with people who came to him with tendentious questions of that kind, and which I very much admire. Instead of just taking the question at the level which is posed to him, Jesus goes straight to the heart of the matter. So instead of arguing about the woman's husbands, he says, takes the Sadducees back to Exodus, which of course is a book that they treated as being authoritative, and he reminds them that the burning bush, God says to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Jesus says to them, the God, not of the dead, but of the living. And the argument, I think, is very powerful. If the patriarchs mattered to God once, I'm sure they did, God is a faithful God, then the patriarchs will matter to God forever. They will not be thrown aside at their deaths like broken pots on a rubbish heap. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will indeed live again in the kingdom of God. That is the only ground for the hope of a destiny beyond death for ourselves or for the universe. There is no natural hope that science could explain or describe for that. But there is every hope that depends upon God's faithfulness. Of course, as Christians, we believe that faithfulness has been exemplified within history through the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ from the dead. And that's the answer. That is how paradise will be regained after paradise has been lost through mortality and decay. And in a sense, I could stop there, but that would be perhaps a little quick to do. Because I think there is a question that we have also to think about and to address, and to ask it simply this, is to ask, can we make sense of the idea of a destiny beyond death? And when you begin to think about that, you begin to see there are two conditions that have to be satisfied, two criteria which have to be satisfied. There's a criterion of continuity and also a criterion of discontinuity. First of all, there has to be a criterion of continuity. It really has to be Abraham, Isaac and Jacob who live again in the kingdom of God. Not new people given the old names for old times' sake, but really the patriarchs who live again. So there has to be some carrier of continuity between our life in this world and life in the world to come. But equally, of course, there would be no particular point, it seems to me, making the patriarchs live again in order simply to die again. So there has to be a criterion of discontinuity. The life of the world to come is going to be different from life in this world. So we ought to spend a little bit of time in thinking about how we might understand those two criteria and how we might make sense of this hope of a destiny beyond death. Let me take the continuity one first of all. In a lot of Christian thinking, the carrier of continuity between life in this world and life in the world to come has been the individual human soul. And very often in Christian thinking, that soul has been thought about as a, so to speak, a detachable spiritual component, released from entrapment in the flesh of the body at death to carry on and be the carrier of life into life in a world to come. But I think the more we have come to think about the nature of life and the nature of ourselves as human beings, we've come to see that this dualist picture of human beings as spiritual souls entrapped within the husk of a fleshly body as not being the right way to think about human beings. We are not apprentice angels waiting release from the flesh of the body. We are psychosomatic unities, as people like to say. We are animated bodies of the incarnated souls. And that's an insight that was not a surprise or shocked in any way most of the writers of the Bible, because the Hebrew way of thinking about human beings is precisely that, as animated bodies rather than incarnated souls. We are a sort of package deal. There is an intimate connection, of course, between mind and matter in which we participate. Hitting me on the head with a hammer would make the point that my conscious life does depend upon the state of my physical body. So, if that's right, if there isn't a detachable spiritual me waiting to be plucked out at my death, used by God as the carrier of continuity, what can we make of the human soul? Have we lost the idea of the human soul? And if we've lost the idea of the human soul, have we lost the idea of continuity? Have we lost the credibility of the hope of a destiny beyond death? Well, of course, I don't think so. We have. But we shall certainly have to reconceptualize the human soul. We shall have to think about it in a different way. Now, that's a pretty ambitious thing to do, and I can only do that in stuttering words, in a way. But I'll try and do the best I can. And what I'm trying to say is that the soul is a really useful idea. The soul must be the real me. Only if it's the real me can it be the carrier of my continuity. And actually, it's almost as difficult to think about the real me in this, what is the real me in this life, as it might be beyond it. What makes me a bald, lame academic, the same as the sprightly young schoolboy with a shock of black hair of more than 70 years ago? At first sight, it's tempting to say it's material continuity. But though it looks like that, that actually is an illusion. Because the atoms that make up our bodies are changing all the time. I have very few atoms that were in my body even 2 years ago. And I'm quite atomically distinct, that schoolboy. The atoms that make up our bodies are changing through wear and tear, eating and drinking all the time. So So material continuity isn't, in fact, present in our lives. So what is the character? What is the carrier of continuity? Well, here I have to wave my hands rather energetically, but I think I'm waving them in the right direction. And I think that the real me, and therefore the human self, is the almost infinitely complex information-bearing pattern. My memories, my character, so on and so on, which is carried by the atoms of my body at any one time. Those atoms change continuously and rapidly. The pattern that is me, of course, evolves as I acquire more memories than my character forms, but that is a continuous unfolding operation. The real me, I think, is the pattern that is me. And that is consonant with a revolution which is just about almost beginning in science. We're just in science beginning to be able to study the behavior of moderately complex systems, treated not as bits and pieces, but treated as totalities in their wholes. It's pretty hard to do, and we can only consider mildly complex systems, nothing like anything as complex as a single living cell. But when we look at those systems, we find that they have amazing powers of self-organization. They can spontaneously create new patterns of structure, which you wouldn't have guessed from simply thinking about the bits and pieces. And I think that information pattern structure is going to be an increasingly important concept in scientific thinking about the nature of the world. In fact, I would venture to guess that by the end of the 21st century, information in this highly generalized sense I'm talking about it will be alongside energy. It's a fundamental consideration. So it makes some sense to think that this is the right way in which to wave our hands, even if, of course, the information-bearing pattern that corresponds to a person must be immensely more complex than anything associated with these simple physical systems. Now, the pattern that is me will, of course, dissolve at my death with the decay of the body. But it seems to me a perfectly coherent belief, and a belief that I embrace, that the faithful God will not allow that pattern to be lost, will preserve that pattern in the divine memory. Now that by itself would not be my having a life beyond death, because I think it is essential to be a human being, that we are embodied beings. That pattern is not just an abstract pattern floating, so to speak, even in the divine mind. It has to be realized and expressed in a body. We are not, as I say, apprentice angels in that sense. And that is why, incidentally, the Christian hope is not spiritual survival, but death and resurrection. The resurrection of the body is an essential part of Christian belief. And I think it is perfectly coherent to believe that God will not only not allow that pattern that is me to be lost, but will, in a great act of resurrection, re-embody that pattern in some new environment of God's choosing. And it would have to be a new environment, because now we come to the discontinuity side of things. It won't be any sense God making me alive again in a world of thermodynamic decay where I'm going to die again. So, my resurrected body will we have to be different from my body in this world. And how that difference might be thought about is interestingly wrestled with by St. Paul quite extensively in the 15th chapter of First Epistle to the Corinthians, talking about resurrection understanding. It seems to be perfectly coherent to believe that God can bring into being a new form of matter, no longer characterized by that thermodynamic drift to decay that characterizes the matter of this world. It could be matter which is endowed with such strong self-organizing principles that decay, drift to decay, will not take place. Again, of course, I don't know how to work that out in detail, but it seems to me a perfectly, perfectly credible thing to believe. If that's right, then there are two further questions we have to ask. One is, where will that matter come from? And I believe it will come from the transformation of the matter of this world. When I'm talking about this new form of matter, I'm talking about what in the Bible we call the new creation. And the picture of the new creation isn't God sweeping the slate clean and starting again and trying to do a bit better the second time. The new creation is the transformation of the old creation. It is creation out of the old rather than recreation out of nothing. And I believe God has a destiny for the whole universe. The whole of creation matters to God in appropriate ways. So the whole universe is going to have a destiny beyond its death, just as you and I are going to have a destiny beyond our deaths. And one of the most striking and amazing chapters in the New Testament is the first chapter of the Epistle to Colossians, which talks about the cosmic significance of Christ, who redeems all things, not just all people, all things, by the blood of his cross. So that's where I think the matter is going to come from. And certainly, I think that's why the empty tomb is part of the resurrection story for Jesus. Jesus, the Lord's risen and glorified body, is the transmuted form of his death body. The resurrection of Christ is the seed event, the seminal event, in which the new creation has already begun to grow, and which will be fully fulfilled. That's why the empty tomb is an extremely important part of the resurrection story. But there's one more question we have to think about, and it's this. If the new creation is going to be so wonderful, free from death and decay and so on, why did God bother with the old? It's a serious question. And I think the answer lies into the fact that God's creative purposes, as I understand them, are intrinsically twofold. God first of all brings into being a creation which has to exist at some distance from the veiled, infinite presence of its creator. If creatures are really to be truly free, to be themselves and indeed to make themselves, they have to be at some distance from their creator, so they're not overwhelmed by the infinite reality of God nakedly unveiled before them. That's the old creation, a world in which there is evolutionary process, the creatures make themselves, and which there is therefore also death and decay. But God's eventual purpose is to draw the whole of creation into a more intimate connection with the divine reality. That is the world of the new creation. And the reason that this matter is different is that it is that unveiled divine presence which is the influence upon it. I put it this way. This is a world that contains sacraments, particular covenant occasions when the veil between us and the divine presence is to some degree thin. The world to come will be totally sacramental, totally suffused with the presence of God. And that is why new creation will be an everlasting creation, a world not subject to death and decay. Now, obviously, there are some speculative aspects of what I've been trying to say. But I think it's very important that we recognize two things. One is that what I've been trying to say, however speculative bits of it may have been, rests on two firm foundations, in my opinion. One, of course, is the faithfulness of God. And the other is the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. So there is a firm foundation for it. I think it's also very important that we wrestle with this question of the meaningfulness of the hope of a destiny beyond death. Many of our friends in this world, it's just so meaningless that they can't even begin to contemplate the possibility of believing and hoping in it. And I think we have a responsibility, knowing we don't know everything about it. In fact, if you're thinking about these problems of destiny beyond death, of eschatology as the last things, as the theologians say, one of the best answers is wait and see. But I think it's necessary for us to try and make sense of it, because I think it's extremely important that the church does not lose its nerve by proclaiming the hope of a destiny beyond death. To have an answer to Stephen Weinberg, that the universe is not pointless, but is the beginning of a great unfolding creative process of God. Well, I like to have a reasonable amount of discussion at the end of what I had to say. I'd like to hear what you think or what you don't think about what I had to say. So I hope now we can have some form of discussion. And I believe there are going to be a couple of people with microphones. And so please wait for a microphone before you ask a question or make a point. I mean, I don't stand here as somebody who knows all the answers. So we have a real discussion. And I want to say one further thing is I'll make a bargain with you. You'll keep a bargain with me. I will try and make my answers concise and to the point. You will kindly make your questions concise and to the point. There's a couple of people down here.
Professor, I wonder if you could just very briefly say where judgment comes into this. Does everything end up on the other side?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's a very important question. I have to give a slightly extended answer to that because it raises a number of important issues. But only slightly extended. First of all, I think that the world to come will also, just as it have its own form of matter, will also have its own form of time. I think there will be time in the world to come. I don't think that our destiny is to share in God's timeless eternity. I think it is as natural for us to be creatures in time as it is to be creatures made of some form of matter. That means that there will be a process in the world to come. And part of that process will involve, I think, two elements of particular significance. One is judgment. Judgment is not appearing before some testy celestial judge Jeffreys wanting to throw you into prison as quickly as possible. Judgment is encounter with reality, of being made to see ourselves as we really are. And that will be a painful process for all of us. All our lives have dross in it, and that dross will have to be dealt with. That's judgment. And I believe that judgment is then followed by what in some traditions is called purgation, which is that doing away with that dross, the cleansing of our souls. That's part of the salvific process of God. And judgment and purgation are both hopeful words in that respect. Then there are what else happens after that? Some people sometimes say, of course, I'd like to live for a bit longer than we do in this world, a few thousand years maybe, but not forever. It'd get a bit boring after a while. Don't want to sit on a cloud strumming a harp and singing hallelujah all the time. Of course you don't. The world to come, I think, will be the unending unveiling of the inexhaustible riches of the divine nature as they are made more open to us. The world to come will be exciting and the very reverse of boring. So thanks for asking that question. Chat down here now, I think, wants to have a go. There's somebody at the back there.
Hi, thanks for the talk. On the subject of fine-tuning of the laws of physics to the universe,
right.
Yes, okay, so the laws of physics appear to be fine-tuned to create this particular universe, but surely if you change the laws slightly, then you may not get carbon created, but creation could follow a different path. You may construct a different periodic table and then have a whole different form of life involved that wasn't based on carbon. How can we model that? Can we say what chance there is of creating a universe of a different structure altogether? Or is this the only option we've got?
That's again a very interesting question. I mean, I only spoke very briefly about fine-tuning. The answer is we don't know the answer to that. I mean, maybe if you change the laws of physics, maybe all forms of, or a subset of the laws, possible laws of physics, all have creative outcomes. We don't have carbon-based life, obviously. There might be a different form of life. We don't know how to answer that. But all I can say is that when you think of the complexity which has to be generated for carbon-based life, the human brain is far and away the most complicated physical system we've ever seen anywhere in the universe. The fact that there would be lots and lots of other possible forms of physics that would result in such complexity seems to me drawing a pretty large blank check on an unknown account. But nobody knows one way or the other how to answer that interesting point you've made. At the back.
Within what you just explained to us, what's your understanding of the four?
Sorry, who can I? I like to see the questioner. Okay, right, that's fine. Okay. Well, my understanding of the four is this. I think the story of Genesis 3 is a very powerful story. I don't think it's the story of a single disastrous ancestral event. But the way I think of it is this way. An amazing event took place in cosmic history when self-consciousness first dawned in our hominid ancestors. I think some of the higher animals are certainly conscious. The primates, for example, the chimp can figure out throughout the stick maybe the banana falls down. But the chimp doesn't project his thought far into the future, far into the past. Doesn't sit there thinking, I'm going to die in 15 years' time. We do. I think at some stage in the coming to be of human life, self-consciousness dawned. It's almost impossible to quite picture it, somebody waking up one day and saying, gee, I can use the future tense. But it clearly happened. it clearly happened. And I believe at the same time that consciousness dawned, then also a God consciousness dawned. I don't think the animals are aware of their creator. No, it is possible for human beings to be. And somehow, I don't think it was a single event, I think it was a process, but somehow our ancestors turned away from God and into themselves. I think that event was, that process was the fall of which we are all the heirs. Human beings became curved in upon themselves. In that story of Genesis 3, the temptation that the serpent whispers in Eve's ears is, you eat this apple, you'll be like God. You won't need God anymore. You're able to do it yourself. That's the fundamental sin. The fundamental sin is to not acknowledge one's need of one's creator. And somehow or other, that's how I see the fall. Somebody down here?
What do you think about the book that says 100 things you must go to or do before you die?
Sorry, you have to say that again. I didn't catch that.
There are books written about 100 things you must do before you die or 100 places you must visit before you die.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's an amusing idea. I think it represents the fact that even if you get really, really elderly, and I speak from experience, you shouldn't give up both the search for new truth and new understanding, and as far as it's accessible to you, new forms of experience. Okay, right here. Yeah, carry on.
Thank you, Professor, for the talk. What do you think about the mixture of continuity and discontinuity on the consequences of our relationship with the planet and the consequences of our actions?
Well, I think if we see the world as a creation, and we see our planet as part of that creation, we see it as the home from which we have ourselves emerged, the dust of the earth, if you like, to use a Genesis symbol, then obviously we should treat the planet with respect. And with gratitude too for the creation. So, the great problem about problems like global warming is that if they're really to be tackled, they require, it seems to me, quite clear political will. And the problem is that the political horizon is usually a pretty short horizon, the next election. And the necessary steps, which will be quite costly steps, to deal with things like global warming, have a much longer perspective than that if they're to be truly affected. But I think those of us who see the world as a creation have an obligation to speak in terms not of no change ever. I mean, an evolving world is a world in which change is part of the process, but certainly not. At the moment, we are, for example, extinguishing species at something I think is 1,000 times the natural rate. That seems to be pretty reckless. Anybody? So this is a big old, yeah, here we are.
Thank you, Professor. Given the laws of material determinism, what are your thoughts on human free will?
Well, that's a big question. First of all, the laws of physics are not deterministic. In post-Newton himself didn't think this way, but both post-Newton people in the late 18th century thought that the world was essentially a clockwork world. The 20th century saw the death of a merely mechanical view of the world through the discovery of intrinsic unpredictabilities present in nature, first through quantum theory in the first quarter of the century, in the middle of the century, the discovery of chaos theory, the butterfly effect in everyday occurrences. So whatever the physical world is, it is certainly not a piece of clockwork. Whatever we are, we're certainly not automata, though I think we always knew that, actually, directly. So the material character of the world, which, of course, we share in our part, is something much more subtle, and I believe more supple, than a mere mechanical picture. That's a quick answer to a very big question, which I have written about a much greater length in some of my books.
Yes. Well, my question is just gone, actually, but I'll just make a couple of quick comments. Firstly, just
really
following up, following up just from that, I feel that if the rationality of our belief in the afterlife is dependent on our having, you know, a satisfactory answer to that question of why God didn't create the new creation to start with, and the most promising answer to that is that it preserves our free will, then I think this has very large implications for our apologetics and evangelism on how much sort of emphasis we're going to have to put on proving free will before we can talk about the afterlife. And I was wondering if you had reflections on that. And
well,
one very other quick
thing.
No.
I think you are reduced to one. I think you had a...
Okay, fair enough. Had
a reasonable go. Well, I, of course, I know philosophers argue it. Many philosophers argue that... what you don't need is radical free will. As long as you do what you want to do, it doesn't matter whether the wanting and the doing are both themselves determined and caused beforehand. I think that's wrong. I think we really are free human beings, and I think the whole Christian understanding of the nature of human beings, the nature of human responsibility, nature of human hope, is destroyed if we are actually covertly automata. So I'm obviously the arguments are complicated, and I don't have time to even mention, let alone try and respond to them. But I think the issue of free will is a very fundamental issue. But basically, I think it's an intuitive issue. I know that I can choose to raise my arm. Yep.
Hi. First of all, thank you very much for the talk. Secondly, the idea of a universe without the decay engendered by the second law of thermodynamics, as I understand it, and I make no claims to be an expert in this, I apologize for being a humble statistician, a large number of the fundamental processes of the universe, for example, gravity, can work solely because this decay, this entropy happens. Do you think that there is a way of, when the new creation comes, there is a way of changing this such that this can continue to happen without the decay? Or will our creator have to create a new, very particular universe for us to inhabit in this new creation?
Well, I did say in my talk that though I believe our destiny is a resurrected destiny, and therefore that we have an embodied destiny, that the matter in which we are embodied will have to have different laws than the matter of this world. Otherwise, it will have the thermodynamic drift to decay. And waving my hands fairly vigorously, I said that we can conceive of the idea of a matter with such strong self-organizing principles, not absolutely bound rigidity, but nevertheless, just strong self-organizing principles that would resist the drift to decay, but nevertheless have sufficient flexibility and freedom to represent a worthwhile environment. That's my guess. It's a course of guess, and I can't work it out. It's well, half past according to the clock in front of me. I don't know. And I see my friend Wes is waiting.
Do you have time for one more question?
Okay, one more then. That's fine.
We've got it over there. Is that okay?
Well, two more then. Oh. Okay, one from the... well, okay. Lady over there anyway.
Thank you very much. In the context of what you've been saying, do you think loved ones and the communion of saints are in heaven now, or does it have to wait until the establishment of a new creation? And does it matter?
Well, that's well. I'm not sure whether it does matter or not. I mean, there's some sense in which it's a very interesting question, but some sense in which the old creation and the new creation exist side by side. I mean, we're in the old creation here. I said that the new creation had come into being, began to come into being, for the resurrection of Christ. And I see the resurrection appearances as the intersection between those different worlds. And therefore it's possible, though we all die at different times in this world, we all arrive at the same time in the world to come. That's an idea. For example, great Roman Catholic theologian Karl Rahner thought was likely. It's possible. But I think I have to go fall back on wait and see at this stage.
Hi there, thanks for the speech. I was wondering, with this second phase of creation, or heaven as you put it...
I'm not hearing you very well.
You're not, okay. With this second phase of creation, which we see as heaven, is that going to be open to everyone, or is this just for the people who put their life in God?
Well, I think that God's mercy, love and mercy, is not a limited time offer. And I don't think it is withdrawn at death. God saw a curtain comes down and God said, okay, gotcha, you're on the wrong side. That's not the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. I don't for a minute mean it doesn't matter what decisions and commitments we make in this life. It is spiritually very damaging to turn away from, deliberately, willfully turn away from God in this life. But I don't think that it's a limited offer only. And I mean, after all, there are many people who, for one reason or another, will not have been able in this life to hear clearly God's offer of love and mercy. You'd be grossly abused by your father as a child. The message of the fatherhood of God would be a difficult message to take on board. So I think that God's love is always there. Whether there will be people who resist God forever is another matter. Some people think that those people who really refuse the divine life deliberately and persistently will simply just fade away. But that's lots more things I could say about that, but that's where we better stop, I think.
Okay, can we have a big round of applause for Professor John Polkinghorne?